You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of September 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tyler Brulé. On today's show, we're slipping on our lederhosen as we take a closer look at the state of brand Germany. The Volkswagen scandal is continuing to spread, but experts suggest the Japanese market could be the big winner. Is hybrid petrol the new diesel? We'll also look at some of the other aspects of German culture as Oktoberfest starts spilling beer in pubs the world over. Also ahead, China is said to be building its first aircraft carrier. Political muscle flexing, or are there other powers at play? I'll be asking my studio guests, Shashank Joshi and Sebastian Borger. Plus, big changes at the top as Ralph Lauren steps down, and is Australia really a terrifying place haunted by bloodthirsty sharks? Much to get through. We'll have all those answers coming up on Midori House with me, Tyler Brulé. So lots of gemütlich feelings here in Studio One at Midori House. My guest today, Sebastian Borger, London correspondent for the Berliner Zeitung, and Shashank Joshi, regular guest, always in his usual seat as well. Shashi, do you always sort of talk to the team, your booking associates here, and say that you want to be on this side of the studio?
There's a small reserved sign here waiting for me every week.
There must be. I guess it can't just happened by accident. Shashank, of course, is with the Royal United Services Institute for War and Conflict here in London. I wanted to maybe start, Sebastian, we'll start in Germany. I was with some of your friends from the Frankfurter Allgemeine a couple of weeks ago, just after the news bulletins were dominated by the story, these I would say rather focused scenes of jubilation at the Munich Hauptbahnhof, all of these trains arriving from the Westbahnhof. And it was interesting because when we looked at the tickers that were on screen, doesn't matter what news outlet you were looking at that time, there was this real sense of excitement. I was talking to young Bavarians. People said they felt incredibly proud about what they were seeing. And so when I made my way to Frankfurt, I asked some of the editors there, is this story, has it been told yet? And it was interesting because from the perspective of the FAZ, they said, no, give us 3 weeks, give us 4 weeks, and this really starts to settle, and we'll start to really see the deeper analysis. We're there now. We're sort of 3 weeks on from those scenes. Is the story being told in the German papers yet?
Increasingly so, yes. And I think, to be fair to FAZ, they told it from the beginning.
Mm.
They said, there is obviously a great crisis and we need to do something, and we are, to some extent, called upon to lead in Europe. But they also said we can't just set aside all rules that have been in place so far.
Mm.
And also we have to, while we talk about, I think that's what the rather conservative FAZ maybe doesn't do so much.
Mm.
While we should talk about the positive impact that immigration can have, not least in a country like Germany, which is with an aging population, we need to talk about the problems as well.
Mm.
And the considerable burden that it brings to start with,
mm.
to integrate and all that. And that's coming through now.
Yeah, is this a challenge if you're a chefredakteur at a major German newspaper still to feel that, you can sort of weigh in responsibly on this debate, or would you say there's a little bit of even self-censorship, a bit of discomfort, to have a view on this topic, even one that might be the prevailing view of your readership?
I think there is, the whole question was framed for the German public much more than for anybody else by the picture of the lorry on the Austrian motorway, not by the picture of the 3-year-old on the beach in Turkey, by the picture of the lorry on the Austrian motorway, where we didn't see bodies, but we were told that 71 people had died in there.
Mm.
And that was obviously analogy was obviously the gas chambers.
Mm.
I think that stirred something very deep in the German psyche, and that was when Angela Merkel took over and said we'll get through it. I think my fellow countrymen and women tend to be slightly over the top sometimes, both in joy and in regret. And I think that there was overwhelming joy, and now there's a little bit of an anti-reaction.
Mm. Shashank, just from not just this side of the channel, but elsewhere in the world, do you think we're also moving to that position as well? That, you know, the realities of coming in have not just what are the German rules, i.e., as they're sort of laid down, of course, in statute books, but also, yeah, what is also the German social capital code as well, that this starts to has a moment of reckoning at this point?
I think that debate is some way off. From this position, from our vantage point over the channel, the debate's been radically different. And I think it's been sublimated into a geopolitical debate about Syria, because we haven't had to confront that particular debate that Germany's had in such a direct, immediate, visceral way.
Mm.
And so our debate has taken this rather odd form, quite a trivial form in a military sense, as to whether we, the UK, should drop a few extra bombs in northern Syria, despite most of the experts saying it won't make a substantial difference. But it's a profoundly important political issue that is splitting the shadow cabinet, and that could cause problems even in the cabinet itself.
Mm.
But to be fair,
that's the form it's taken.
Britain gave a lot more aid to the refugee camps in the countries around Syria when Germany was still asleep.
That's true, and our debate has been slightly schizophrenic. There has been a sort of a hand-wringing as well that has also failed to account for the substantial economic contribution the UK has made. But I think people view that as a sort of guilt money, in a way. There's a sense of discomfort with pointing to it as if it's sort of saying, well, we're paying to have this problem taken off our hands. And that's the Prime Minister's policy, which is we should be taking people directly from the camps, not those who have made it to Europe.
Mm. I'd be fascinated, I guess, from maybe the Berlin side. I mean, when you look at the defense ministry, people are also sort of covering, certainly the foreign ministry as well. Has the German debate also moved, right to, the killing fields of Syria as well, in terms of, and it's of course always touchy, the topic of German intervention. What can Germany do at source? You know, does this even enter the pages at all?
No. Military is it's out of the question. I mean, people are still recovering from what they perceive to be a lost cause, which was Afghanistan.
Mm.
Of course, we've just read that the Taliban have recaptured Kunduz, which was the German place in Afghanistan for 11 or 12 years.
25 German troops lost in Kunduz.
Yes.
And the same way we look at Helmand, Germany will now start looking at Kunduz.
Indeed. And so there's absolutely no. But that's the problem I have looking at it at my country from the outside.
Sure.
That, you know, the foreign policy engagement is never, ever framed in military terms.
Mm.
It simply doesn't, you know, we drag along if we are pushed very, very badly, but it wouldn't be part of the debate to start with.
Is that wrong of Germany? Do you think that, given on one side, yeah, we have this human crisis, this being, of course, one of the world's biggest economies. And, of course, we know the history. And of course, you mentioned, of course, you know, the recent foray into Afghanistan. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean, of course, you know, direct intervention and German, air support or anything like this, but other means that Germany could be supporting this.
I think it's important to sort of also be aware of Germany's policy in Iraq, where, of course, much was made of the fact that Germany provided considerably more armed assistance in the form of weapons and ammunition to the Kurds than the UK did. So it's evolving, it's changing, and the political sensitivities obviously mean that things like handing over machine guns is a lot easier than deploying German troops.
Mm.
But I do think it's important, as the UK, certainly France to some extent, confront crises in their armed forces, big cuts, huge shrinkages in manpower, that sort of Germany slowly begin to take its rightful place alongside those three in certain types of multilateral operations that are relatively uncontentious, like airstrikes in Iraq, at least, if not Syria.
If we're going to shore this up, Josh, and clearly there was so much discussion, you know, people pinpointing not just ministers in Berlin, but also on a state level, when we really saw this refugee crisis, you know, really kicking in, arriving in German Hauptbahnhofs all over the place. And everyone said, well, I guess we'll all be fine as long as Germany Incorporated is okay. And now we're 1 week on and we're living with a VW crisis and not, you know, all is not well. Not just if we look at a corporate level, we of course have to look at even the government's or at least a state's investment in VW. Does this really filter up as a problem for Berlin?
It will do so. And, you know, we know from our experience here and from almost any country one cares to look at that issues of integration, issues of immigration, these are far, far less contentious in times of plenty, in times of economic, flourishing or progress. And when things go down, they look a lot worse. The whole gloss on these things can change in a matter of a few months as economic changes begin to take hold. Of course, we shouldn't over-extrapolate from the Volkswagen story. One hopes, you know, the contagion effects will be relatively limited. But I think the challenge has to be looked at as it will be in a time of slump, in a time of difficulty, not in the sort of the flush, the glow of sort of a social bonding with everyone on side.
Mm. Do you think that there's a lot of reforecasting going on at the finance ministry? A lot of calculators and abacuses out trying to square a new set of numbers, in terms of figuring out, how do we find more German teachers? How do we just make sure that, you know, we're prepared for this right now?
I should hope so. I mean, the finance minister Schäuble has already told the Bundestag that he needs something like 3 billion euros for initial integration tasks. But I mean, he'll also have to recalibrate his tax income. Yes. You know, when you look at Volkswagen and the damage that it's done beyond the company itself to brand Germany, there's no doubt about it.
Yeah, the only silver lining being if there's a sort of spate of cost cutting that increases competitiveness. But I mean, you know, even that's very uncertain.
Mm. Do you think that this is a story which, yeah, of course, it is dominated front pages all over the world and bulletins, etc. But, you know, we are close to the epicenter. This is a story which, you know, like, of course, broke in the United States. But if I'm in a big market like Brazil, and I'm also not looking at the front pages all the time, I'm not really sort of concerned with what Globo might be reporting or Folha de São Paulo. I just want to buy a new car, and I've got Mazdas, but I also might have various vehicles from the VW lineup. Do I ultimately care, Sebastian? I'm wondering.
To be honest, ask the person in Sao Paulo. It's very difficult for me to ascertain that. I do think, it's the prestige of the brand that's gone down the pan. It's the problem that all regulating bodies will look very, very closely at their technology, at least for the next few years.
Yeah, I think the knock-on effect will be less about diesel specifically, more about the bigger question about, if these emissions are fixed, what about basic consumption? What about basic mileage? Basic CO2. And that, I think, will be where it really hits very hard. There will be a spurt of regulatory attention, and then we will see the reputational knock-on effect seep to other brands.
Mm. Which, to be honest, I think, you know, who was it who said every crisis is a chance? This is the chance for environmental organizations to come through with their quite proper arguments, I think, and say, let's try and reduce car use anyway, in the first place. And also, of course, particularly in Germany, I think the whole development of hybrid technology has been neglected over the years. You know, okay, Toyota was the market leader, but they could have caught up if they wanted to, but they didn't want to. Mm. They concentrated on diesel because it was, I don't know, easier or whatever.
It was certainly an opportunity for Brand Switzerland over the weekend as well, because, you know, here suddenly Switzerland could say, okay, you know, we're going to, you know, impose some type of ban on these vehicles on lots, just to get Sepp Blatter off out of the headlines.
The front line.
And, okay, let's get Brand Switzerland at least show us that we're doing something good. Shashank, I just want to look at Brand Germany though. We've had, Yeah, of course, if we rewind many months, we had the German Wings incident, and this raised a lot of questions. And of course, from a leadership point of view, here we had the CEO of the airline at first sort of saying, this is unthinkable. We dig a little bit deeper, and we, of course, then find out that there were problems, and the airline did know, certainly about the mental history. And then, of course, here we're looking at a major automotive player as well. But, when you are the world's fourth biggest economy, do these things really hit home? Will they be topics for year-end review when everyone sort of looks back at 2015, or will there be other things that sort of rise to the fore, do you think?
There's cause for reflection, but I also think the perception we had for a long time was of a distinctive German model of capitalism, and it was associated in part also with a certain idea of ethics, a certain idea of corporate responsibility, corporate rectitude. Mm. Now, whether it's right that a few, what are really disconnected, scattered incidents, as substantive as they are within their industries, should be allowed to tarnish that is another question. But I think it will linger in our perception of that model for quite a while to come, years ahead.
Sebastian, do you think that our view, though, of, and it's interesting when Shashank talks about this view of sort of corporate Germany, but is our view when we think of just business in Germany, it's not really corporate? Is it more, when we think about German companies, we're actually thinking about the Mittelstand in many ways, that when we think about that sort of solid nature, it is, whether it's the 15 to 200 person company in Baden-Württemberg or in the deepest parts of Bavaria, where we really think about what underpins the entire country.
And I would argue that their business ethics are still intact. Winterkorn, I mean, this former Volkswagen CEO and the whole company, and I think the whole summit of German companies in the DAX index have taken over Anglo-Saxon accounting practices as well as ethics for a long time.
Mm.
Someone who takes home, 22 million euros? What's the difference to the Chrysler CEO? And let's not forget that we've had quite a remarkable scandal in Volkswagen a few years ago when all these bribes for people on the board, employee representatives on the board. It's not a clean company by any means.
Mm. Just before we go to our break, I wanted to ask both of you. Yeah, Oktoberfest really sort of moving into high gear. Dirndls. I was going to say dirndls are what I guess your trust into your dirndl. Lederhosen have been pulled on, etc. And it's interesting to look at this other side of the sort of soft power phenomenon that. It's not just about going back to certain corners of Brazil or Canada where Oktoberfest is big, Shashank, but this is something which has taken hold all over Asia, etc. Is there sort of also what is the link and attraction? Is it just that notion we can put on a hat with a nice bit of I guess it's what's the gums, Sebastian? Is it like a mountain deer
goat.
Or goat
yeah,
or something?
Yeah.
So yes, you've got this like lovely plume on top. Is that what excites people, or is there also the attachment to, yes, this is the country that BMW comes from, and if I drink lots of beer, maybe I will sort of drive the Audi of my dreams at some point. I'm wondering that sort of external attraction of that we're seeing all over the world right now.
That's interesting. I mean, I think most of the sort of internationalized Oktoberfests we see are just sort of the wholly indigenized things, right?
Mm.
But I'm really interested in your idea that there's a sort of pastoral attraction to it. There's a kind of a sense of outdoorsiness, of rustic enjoyment that appeals. But I think it's something pretty universal, right? In terms of just getting together at long tables and drinking. I don't think one needs to penetrate too deeply to see the global appeal of the different variants of that.
I spoke to a Danish guy who brings Oktoberfests from Lake Constance to Britain and Copenhagen and so. And he says, when I asked him, well, why, what's the attraction, do you think? Well, he said, Germans and Brits, whatever else they share or don't, they share a love for beer, sitting together and singing together.
Mm. And just on that, I'm just fascinated, Sebastian, as well. You know, I've noticed, you know, when you spend time in and around Bavaria, you know, it used to be that you could go to, you know, any number of sort of major halls, and you wouldn't have to be sort of in Tracht. And but now
it's increased. No doubt about it. Yes.
And I'm wondering, is that and not just on the part of sort of the funny tourists, but you know, but even amongst, you know, German friends I know, they said, oh yes, I would have gone in jeans and maybe just a Tracht. Now I sort of have to do the whole thing. You know, is that also sort of a reaction in a way of defining oneself as German? I can wear this gear and I can wear it with pride. I've been trying to work through it. What's happening, do you think?
You have to make a distinction between being German and being Bavarian.
This is true, yes.
I am Bavarian. I would never, ever wear something like that.
Ever, ever?
Ever. Because I grew up...
grew up in it?
Or? I went to school very near the Theresienwiese, where the Oktoberfest is held. So I've seen everything you don't want to see as a 13-year-old. I will never even touch it with a barge pole. But I totally agree that your observation, it's become much more mainstream. Mm. Much more mainstream. Out of the conservative, it was very much in the conservative corner, and it's now very much through society, and people enjoy, it's a bit like the English, people enjoy dressing up and having a good time for an
evening. The equivalent would be sort of mainstream donning of Morris dancing kit in sort of main cities every year, whereas, you know, that...
Which doesn't happen.
Which mercifully doesn't happen.
maybe not quite as attractive. Anyway, I think Sebastian Burger of the Berlin Inside has opened up that we have to see if what he was wearing when he was going to school, by the way, and whether there was sort of any sense of Trachten childhood, maybe there's some trauma, etc. Also, Shashank Josh is also here from Rusi as well. Going away for a short break, we're going to be talking aircraft carriers and sharks after this.
Kiosk Cafe is coming to London. From the founders of Monocle comes a newsstand and coffee bar concept inspired by Europe's finest city street kiosks. There's a great selection of magazines and newspapers, of course, including print-on-demand titles from all around the world, making Kiosk Cafe in Paddington a real celebration of the best in print and paper. And there's more. With all press coffee and travel essentials from some of Monocle's favorite brands available, too, Kiosk Cafe is the perfect spot for business travelers and visitors to London, as well as print aficionados. Come and visit us to see for yourself. Kiosk Cafe is opening soon at Norfolk Place, moments from Paddington Station. Kiosk Cafe newsstand and coffee bar. We look forward to welcoming you.
/18:22 here in London. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé. Also, Sebastian Burger is here from the Berliner Zeitung, and also Shashank Joshi from Rusi here in London. Shashank, interesting bit of news. Supposedly an Airbus satellite was looking at Chinese shipyards, and it looks like they found a very, very large platform that probably is not going to be a supertanker. We're hearing from lots of analysts that this is going to be China's first homegrown aircraft carrier. Probably not much news. We've been hearing about it for a while, but I guess we have to take this as confirmation.
Well, not quite yet, although, because it could be an amphibious ship, it could be a large hospital boat. There's lots of things these huge hulls can be. Mm. But as you say, we've known they want to build one. There's a well-established Chinese model in defense, as in many other things. You obtain someone else's kit, whether by stealing it or buying it, and then you copy it as well as you can. This is a little bit different, and I don't think people always understand how incredibly difficult it is to build an aircraft carrier, let alone operate it. You know, when the US built these, started using them heavily in the 50s, 40s, 50s, they lost thousands and thousands of jet planes and pilots trying to land on a moving ship. So, you know, they can build the hull, they can build the thing, but can they build the catapult? Can they put the reactors on top? There's no evidence they can build the reactors. Can they then fly on and off it very effectively at sea? So this will be, we're 10, 15 years away from China using this thing in a serious way.
You'd be really breaking a sweat, though, if you were the head, not just of the maritime architecture people responsible for it, but having to, of course, answer to Beijing to, of course, make this happen when they've seen Japan launch okay, the Japanese call it, what, a helicopter destroyer? I think I would say if you sort of, if you held it up to, you know, a four-year-old, what is this? It's an aircraft carrier. So Japan's put their second one out to sea. I mean, this also just must annoy the hell out of them in Beijing as well, and really makes them speed up the process.
And not just that. I mean, the Indians have plans for a three-carrier fleet. Even the Thai, have an aircraft
They've got an aircraft carrier.
Okay, it's mothballed somewhere in an attic, but it's there. I think the Chinese maritime doctrine we all saw came out earlier this year, it made very, very clear the focus may be the near seas, the first island chain confronting US forces, but in the medium term, they will be sailing further out. They've just tied up to open a new facility, although it's effectively going to be a base in Djibouti. So their ambitions are big, but as I say, we're talking here a decade away before we will start seeing Chinese planes whizzing around on the open Pacific really properly.
And sorry, I was just going to say, Sebastian, do you need, I mean, everyone can sort of talk, as Shashank, about wanting to have, you know, a blue water force that that they can, you know, properly be out there in the game internationally. To really be part of the club, do you need an aircraft carrier?
I think in this day and age, the value of carriers is changing, and that's for two reasons. One of them is that anti-access weapons are becoming more potent. What that means is weapons that can take out ships very, very easily. They are becoming cheaper, more widely available, so smaller countries can knock out your enormous carrier at long distance. And I think number two, the other big issue, is that aircraft can be travel at longer ranges with tankers. So China, if it wants to, say, you know, get near the Malacca Straits with a bomber, it can do so with refueling aircraft.
Especially, but Germany's been very good when it does use its military power. I can think of, you know, seeing the Iron Cross on the fuselage of many large Airbuses after the tsunami in Southeast Asia, that here you saw the Luftwaffe. It was deployed very early. So do we also sometimes forget that also that these tools can also, you know, increasingly also have a humanitarian role as well?
Very much so, but they've got to function first. And of course, we've had a great crisis in the German military, that their kit isn't working. You know, 60% of all tanks not up to proper standards. I mean, it's
who knows what the emissions are on those things.
Well, yesterday I wondered if this is really something which has come in and to land in the lap of your defense minister. I mean, she seems to be almost a bit of a poster girl in not just, well, probably your title, but in, you know, in Der Spiegel and Stern, always in pages that I probably wouldn't want to be in.
She's very ambitious. She wants to be Merkel's successor whenever the time comes.
And is that likely?
If she survives,
if she did the plagiarism issue that we're dealing with,
when did we ever expect medical PhDs to have any substance whatsoever?
When did you ever expect a medical PhD to be a German defense minister? But
if she survives the graveyard of which is the defense ministry and has been for 40 years, she's got a good chance.
Just before we go, there's an interesting story. Who knows? You know, it's a little cat stories, isn't it? That you know, we know that these are things that sort of, you know, advance very quickly up the top of the food chain when it comes to you know, any type of news ranking. Sharks are also there as well. You could say they could sort of compete with cats. And Australia is obviously sort of looking at some new types of repellents, etc. I mean, Shasha, do you think this is something which has been drummed up by you know, Tourism Australia, that they think that you know, we have to make sure we've got full Qantas Emirates planes heading our way over the next few months? Is this really sort of a reputational issue? We also know that they're also health and safety crazy in Australia, but that's a whole other program as well.
Well, in Australia, one needs to be health and safety crazy. I think, you know, it's yes, they may be drumming it up, but there has been an increase in shark attacks. That's a concrete trend. What I'm fascinated by is the kind of technological innovation it stimulated. I mean, I read this story in the Financial Times expecting to read about, you know, big nets or sort of physical things. These are really really impressive devices that are stimulating gel in the shark's mouth, generating spasms, but without killing the shark, without requiring culls that are keeping them away. I mean, this seems to be stimulating some fantastic innovation in this process.
Sebastian Burger, will you go back in the water or will you be back?
I love Australia. I have family there. I mean, there's what was it, 9 attacks this year?
Yeah.
9 fatal attacks.
Fatal attacks, exactly.
I suppose you have to tenfold the attacks where people are injured.
Mm.
But given the fact that the Australians are on the beach all the time, basically.
Yeah. I think they've done all right.
It's not, basically. I'd agree.
Shushing Joshi, Sebastian Burger, we have to leave it there. That's all the time we have for today's edition of Midori House. Our program was produced by Ben Ryle and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, researcher with Federica Romagnello, and our studio manager, Chris Chilpers. Goodbye from London. Thanks.